Broadcasting from the studios of Business Radio X, it's time for Litigator's Lounge. This show is brought to you by Hall Booth Smith, guiding clients through challenging workplace legal issues. Now, here are your hosts.
Hello. Thank you for tuning in to this week's episode of Litigator's Lounge, your go-to source for insightful discussions on workplace dynamics and legal issues. I'm Jackie Voronov, and I'm here with my sensational, albeit slightly under the weather, co-host, Shiley Bannon. How are you today, Shiley?
I'm okay, Jackie, though unfortunately, instead of drinking my lychee martinis, I've had to switch to a hot toddy.
I'm going to tell you, my grandmother has said it from the beginning that those lychee martinis have a lot of medicinal properties. And if my Baba Luba says that it's helpful, you can take that to the bank.
Okay, maybe I should switch back. Maybe the vodka would be good for me. What do you think?
I've never heard anyone. What's the worst that could happen? Let's think about it that way.
I wouldn't notice that I'm sick anymore.
That's exactly right. So on this episode, we're going to be rounding out our coverage of Women's History Month, which is basically like the ultimate highlight reel of Both Lady moments throughout history, or as I like to call it, the Oscars. But instead of handing out golden statues, we're applauding women who have rocked the world without actually needing a red carpet to do it. And speaking of women who ran the world before Beyoncé even sang about it, we are honored today to have a very special guest, Hall Booth Smith's very own Teresa Tomlinson. Thank you, Teresa, for joining us.
It's great to be here.
Do we have like a thunderous applause soundbite that we can put here? That's like,
what? Yes, I'm sure that we can make that happen. We have some great producers that will make that happen. But I'm actually applauding. You just can't hear it because I'm using AirPods Pro today. Teresa, I'm gonna give a little bit of an intro about Teresa because I have fangirled over Teresa for longer than she probably has been aware of my existence. Teresa is one of our partners here at HBS, and she works out of our Columbus, Georgia office. She is one of the most accomplished women I've ever had the privilege of meeting. Teresa is a graduate of the All-Women's Liberal Arts School, Sweetbriar College, as well as a graduate of the Emory University School of Law. She began her legal career as an attorney with the firm Pope, McGlamory, Kilpatrick, Morrison, and Norwood, and eventually became the firm's first female partner. She later became the executive director of Midtown, Inc., which was a nonprofit community renewal organization. She left that position in 2010 to run for mayor of the city of Columbus, Georgia, winning and becoming the first female mayor of that city. For those of you who aren't familiar with Georgia geography, Columbus is right on the Alabama-Georgia border, and I think that it's actually just south of what they call the Nat Line, but Teresa will correct me if I'm wrong about that. She's nodding, so I think I got that. While she was mayor, she served two consecutive terms, and the city was named as one of the top 50 best-run cities in America 2 years in a row. Her administration reduced crime by 40%, she balanced the city budget, and she reformed the city pension plan, amongst many other accomplishments. While serving as mayor of Columbus, as if she didn't have enough else to do, Teresa and a group of Sweetbriar College alumni raised $28.5 million to prevent the closure of her alma mater. And she also testified as a key witness in a lawsuit brought before the Virginia Supreme Court to enjoin the closure of the school. Teresa completed her second term as mayor in January of 2019, and ran in the Democratic primary for the Georgia Senate race of 2020. Teresa has been a partner with Hall Booth Smith since 2019, trying countless cases in both state and federal jury trials on behalf of defendants and plaintiffs, and has served as a mentor to many women inside of our firm and in the community at large. Teresa, welcome. We are very glad to have you.
Well, it's great to be here.
When we were talking about putting together this podcast and inviting you on, Jackie and I initially, we're talking about bringing in a guest, and we thought, okay, who can we bring in for Women's History Month? And we both thought to ourselves at the exact same time, Teresa Tomlinson is the perfect person for this. We're going to talk a lot about your career and how being a woman has affected you, both in terms of overcoming challenges related to your perceived challenges related mm-hmm. to your gender and the strengths that it's lent you. But tell me from a 30,000 foot view, what is your thoughts on Women's History Month and being asked to be here and the role that being a woman has played in your career?
I actually relish the opportunity to talk about my career and my journey because it's been such a surprise to me. I always say that I'm the Forrest Gump of my own life. And so it's allowed me this sort of outside perspective, I think, in a way to, it really wasn't planned like you might think it was. I just went with the current and found certain things crossing my path. And so that allowed me, in a way, to stand back and see what was happening. And Women's History Month is something I've spoken about a lot. Obviously, in my prior roles, I was asked to speak. And I just have this real sense of the history of the people who came before us that made such strides and how we really fit into that, even if we don't think that what we do is particularly important, even if we think we're the Forrest Gumps of our own lives, we're all moving down the field, gaining yardage, and others are watching us. And it's amazing to me how they leapfrog. And so I love opportunities to come and speak a little bit, because I know somewhere out there, there's a Teresa Tomlinson 35 years behind me coming up, and maybe one thing we say will make her path a little easier.
I agree. I totally agree. And I think that even as you're, and tell me if you agree with this, but as you go through all of the different chapters in your professional, your personal, your political career, you don't set out with this ideal of I'm going to bash down doors with, you know, this idea that as a woman, I'm going to do it. It's not until you're looking back with 2020 hindsight that you realize, wow, I just accomplished something that I didn't even, number one, realize that I could, or that anybody else gave me the credit that I thought I could. It's pretty astonishing when you do a look back as opposed to a look forward, I think.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I'm amazed of is I came in, obviously, a bit behind probably most of the people who will be listening to this, but certainly it was post-women's rights movement, although that's a chronic continuing thing, right? But it was after the ERA debate and women felt like they were making such strides and that type of thing. And so I certainly felt like I was a liberated woman, a feminist, even went back in the day when that was a really bad thing to say out loud. But a pro-woman, they had a lot of opportunities. And it wasn't until I was in public office, I'd say 45, I was 45 years old, until I realized that a lot of the hurdles I had was because of my gender. I thought it was because of my age. I thought it was because I was young and dumb, frankly, inexperienced. I thought it was because I was inexperienced and that people were treating me like that because I hadn't earned my stripes. And whereas some of that may be true, because I tended to always be in fields where I was 20 years younger than everyone else in the room, period. Most everybody was my father's age, as I say a lot, and it's true. So I always thought that I was being diminished and disregarded because I didn't have the gravitas via experience to say it. It wasn't until I had gravitas and title and I was being disrespected that I thought, wait a minute, how could this possibly be happening? And had the confidence to know that what I was saying was a good idea or good solid position to take, that I realized it had to be gender. And then it really just like a whip, it just snapped the pieces of my prior life into place. And I saw a greater picture.
I think that anybody who knows you, and after this episode, I think people will have a greater insight into what it is to be all things Teresa Tomlinson. But there's no question that anybody who knows you and who works with you, as we're lucky to do, knows that you are far more than just a footnote in a man's history. You have absolutely, you have done a lot of inspiring things that anybody, male or female, would be proud to have on their curriculum vitae, starting with from your political aspirations, which I think we should definitely would be a great kickoff point because you are the first female mayor that Columbus has known. Tell us a little bit about how you decided to run for that position and how that unfolded.
First of all, I can't believe I ever left the practice of law. I mean, I loved it so much while I was doing it. I loved the firm I was with. The cases excited me. I always have seen the law like reading a murder mystery or a caper novel of some sort. I love research. I love writing. I love oral arguing and being in front of juries. So how in the world I ever left it is still really a mystery to me. But I was following things that I was very passionate about, and had the type of law and I was practicing was really intense, and usually it had a high upside and then a low trough. So we had time to take vacations during the trough, but it during the cases, it was the early days of complex litigation. You missed mother's birthdays. You left Christmas at noon just because you didn't get the type of 3-day weekends everybody else got. And so I was going to take some time. I had back-to-back big cases with no trough. And I asked my partners if I could take a little time and do some, I guess what they would call now rainmaking, but go off and have a chair position with the ABA and represent the firm in that way. And they said, sure, take a year, do those kinds of things. We can use them and you'll still be with the firm. And I decided to, somebody came to me and asked me if I would be the temporary administrator of a nonprofit. And I said, sure. How much time can a nonprofit possibly take? I can do that in my sleep, right? I got involved. I loved it. And it became this full-time thing. And they were doing a nationwide search and they offered that to me. That was Midtown. And I did it and it became such a passion of mine. I just can't even tell you how excited I was to get up and go and do the great things that we did. And there was this failure of leadership, not because any of the people were bad, but because they couldn't get it together. They couldn't see, the community couldn't see the path forward. And the only thing I can equate it to is I always give these sports analogies because my sister was such an amazing athlete. And I was not, but I went to all her stuff. But it's like being in the batter's box and sitting there warming up for a pitcher you know you're going to hit. You're just sitting there, you're like, I'm going to hit this guy. This is going over the fence. And I was sitting there and I could just see the path that the city needed to take to revitalize these in-town communities. And then the mayor announced he wasn't going to run again. He actually told me, he picked me up to go drive around with some neighborhoods that we were trying to revitalize. And I was trying to explain to him how this could work and be such a financial boon for the city as well as a community enhancement. And he said, you know, I'm not going to run again, Teresa. You should think about it. First time it ever crossed my mind. And I thought, what? I mean, what are you talking about? But then I thought, wow, if I can see how the ball should be hit and I actually have the bat, what could we do? And so I went and I just ran and I started talking about stuff, touching third rails, just saying things that needed to be said because I didn't have to win. I want to say I didn't care to win. That sounds disrespectful, but I didn't have to win. I wasn't that invested. I just wanted to say the things that needed to be said to show the path forward. And it was this really refreshing. It became this community momentum thing. Everybody got behind the provocative ideas. And it was one of the most exciting times of my life. But never once did I run or think about being the first woman mayor. And it wasn't until the night I was elected. And I think I mentioned this as we were talking leading up to the broadcast today, that they announced I was the projected winner, and our campaign headquarters was on TV live, and people went nuts. We had balloons, and people were going crazy, jumping up and down with signs. And people started coming to the headquarters because it was an exciting place to be, and it was on TV. And I had two consecutive events where older women came up to me and virtually said the same version of the same thing, which was, "You would not have been elected mayor if I had not poured coffee for 20 years for men I was more qualified than. You would not have been mayor if I had not taught men who were incapable of doing the job I had been educated and trained for, and I had to train them to do that job." And they were so right, and I was so ashamed that I had not run or said anything about being the first woman mayor that I began to it every time I had a microphone, speak about women and how we do make those incremental changes that maybe you don't even see that make the path easier for the next one.
Yeah, I think that sometimes when we're, I don't know about you, but sometimes when I'm doing things, I forget that I'm doing things in my own name and on behalf of other women. I don't make it a gender thing. I make it on the qualifications thing. I had an argument with an opposing counsel recently, and he sent me an email saying it's a sex harassment case, and he demanded we have a female mediator. His thought process, of course, being, well, a female mediator is going to be more sympathetic to our cause somehow. Mm-hmm. I don't know why, but that just struck a nerve with me. It mm-hmm. bothered me because mm-hmm. in my head, I thought he was basically saying, all right, rather than focusing on who's got actual dispute resolution capabilities, it's about whether this person has ovaries. Like, to me, I thought this was just offensive on every level. Mm-hmm. And I fired back and I said, listen, I think this isn't some like misguided dating app. We can evaluate mediators based on their qualifications and their ability to settle this case. And I think that what you're doing is really offensive and furthering stereotypes. And he went off the rails on me when I tell you. He was just like, you're offensive. You're horrible. You're disgusting. You're embarrassing yourself, he told me. I was like, I'm embarrassing myself. I don't need you to help me embarrass myself. I know. I get it. But the point being is sometimes gender, there's a time and a place when gender should be front and center. And I think that you have highlighted with a giant fluorescent marker of when that is with everything that you've accomplished. And sometimes there's others out there who try and make it about the wrong thing. And I love what you've been doing. I really do.
I think it's really interesting. Of course, the more mileage I get on myself and in my career, I'm constantly amazed at the revelations. I will tell you, I don't know this gentleman that you were speaking with or anything about other than what you've just said. But I will tell you, I find that actually men that consider themselves to be fairly enlightened, it may well be enlightened in many regards, tend to miss the point profoundly sometimes in a way that makes their conduct maybe not as offensive as somebody who's intentionally demeaning a woman or marginalizing a woman, but in a way that has the same effect sometimes. And so I think I try to give grace to my male colleagues when something like that happens and give them points for trying, hopefully not in a way that they were pandering or trying to take advantage of genders for their own benefit, but in a way that just helps educate them. I found some amazing pushback even fairly recently in the last 5-6 years of men I felt knew better, but made huge discriminatory or marginalizing effect on in important positions, and tried to kindly bring it to their attention. And the pushback, much as you said, this is what made me recall that the pushback on all of those occasions was venomous and hot.
Oh, venomous. They get so touchy.
And I get because they feel they're trying and they feel like they're enlightened and they're very offended that you would say that to them. Of course, now you're then trying to soothe them and their bruised ego from the fact that they stepped on you or some other woman in the room and you were just trying to point it out. Now all of a sudden you're trying to say, oh, Joe, you're not a bad guy. You're a good guy. And so there you are now soothing.
Oh, I didn't say that.
But I've seen that and I found myself doing that and saying, now, wait a minute. Let's get back to the original circumstance here. I was simply pointing out that whether you intend it or not, that was inappropriate behavior. And the effect of your behavior was most certainly to marginalize that woman. That's what you did. And that's what you subconsciously or otherwise your actions did. And that is absolutely the effect you had.
For sure.
I think we just have to keep bringing it back to the merits of it. And women, speaking to the mediator you were talking about, whether the gender, women do, your reaction to that, of course, doesn't surprise me at all because you wanted merits. Women, it's amazing how we don't speak about our gender. We're always speaking about how capable we are.
Yeah.
And we're looking for that in other people, right? I don't care about their gender. I want the best one. People would always say that about, oh, we want a woman judge. I was like, I want the best judge.
Who was it that's
reading the briefs? And so women in broad generalizations, a lot of this conversation we have today, I'm sure will be, but women tend to be looking for the merit of it and not the quick fix of it.
That's what I was trying to get the point across. And his position was that a female mediator would make his client more comfortable. I said, well, take her, if this she's looking for comfort, litigation probably isn't the best venue, I think, personally. And as much as I would like her to be comfortable and what have you, I think that a male is just as capable of doing that. And like, I found myself like coddling this person. I'm like, you're the one who's offensive. I'm like, she's represented by you,
a male
attorney. You can't get her comfortable. What do I need to go get a female to comfort her for? But I digress.
I know.
I wasn't going to take this on much further because, but like the point was, I think that there's men who think that they're so progressive and don't even realize that they're being discriminatory. And then there's men who are real allies to women in general. And I'm lucky, at least. And I don't know about you, Shiley, or you about Teresa, but on my comeuppance over the last nearly two decades, I've been fortunate enough to work with a number of men who have had, who tacitly made efforts to build, empower, support, and be, you know, allies mm-hmm. along the way. I don't know how your experience has been and whether you found that you had to sign a machete your way through a, mm-hmm. a world of testosterone in Columbus.
I had a partner tell me once that I should really think hard about whether I wanted to have kids.
I had a partner one time tell me he didn't care if I could read when he hired me. I was like, lucky for you.
I had one tell me once that everything you always say is an emergency.
It is an emergency.
And I was like, I'm sorry, what now? And of course, he was building on the histrionics aspect of it, that I didn't know the difference between something that really was an emergency and just me not being able to handle pressure. I'm not really sure. But yeah, there's so many tropes in life with gender, with race, with all sorts of things, ethnicity. And we just have to be so careful. I learn every day about things that I used to say 25 years ago that I didn't know the origin of, or I didn't appreciate the origin of, that reinforces tropes we should not reinforce or be a part of whatsoever. And I think sometimes our male friends just don't know. And so I seek to say, don't say that. I was Homeland Security Director for 16 counties in Georgia and 7 counties in Southeast Alabama. I know what an emergency looks like. thank you very much. Public Safety Director for the police and the fire and the in the prison. I think I know what a prison break looks like. I think I know that we have an emergency.
Do you feel, as you've taken leadership positions, so first becoming the first female partner at your first firm, and then becoming the executive director of the nonprofit and being a mayor and now being a shareholder at HBS, do you think that your experience as a woman in those fields and coming up in those fields has made it so that when you're dealing with leadership decisions, not necessarily direct supervisory decisions, but when you're in these leadership decision-making places, are you noticing more of the inequities or areas where improvement could be made for women or for other people who historically have been overlooked or stereotyped in negative ways?
I think positions that have access or power, maybe, is a more base word. Involved in them, you necessarily will see that because it's brought to your doorstep, because you're the one in a position, whether you're the lawyer who understands the system or you're a mayor or whatever it might be, you're the person who's in a position to give voice to their issue and the one who's in a position to find a solution to what they're doing. And so, yeah, you see it because people bring it to you. And also you're just in a position to see more. So you bet. I've seen all sorts of jaw-dropping things and related to women and smart women, not women who are undereducated. I mean, that we could find, you know, 10 billion examples of women who are already marginalized by the system in so many ways. I'm talking about myself. I'm talking about women who are very capable, who are fierce, and who struggle against being marginalized. The fact that somebody could walk across my path and think they're going to bully or marginalize me, and not that I'm like I'm going to kick everybody's butt. I don't walk like that. I don't act like that. But the fact that somebody would walk across the street to disrespect or marginalize me just always shocks me. I just usually stand there slack-jawed for a few minutes trying to say, I'm sorry. I'm a 59-year-old woman. I what did you say? and yet they do. So if they do it to me, are they doing it to other people? You bet. You bet it's happening. And a lot of it is, I think, the difference to me and our colleagues who are well-meaning. And when I say colleagues, by the way, I'm talking all men, colleagues of humanity, colleagues in life. I'm not talking about colleagues at this law firm or just lawyers in general. Think about, you know, our brothers. The difference in those who are making not just a misstep because they didn't know better or couldn't find the right word. That's not what this is about. It's not a word game. The ones who are making the real impact to marginalizing a woman, it usually stems from a real insecurity. They don't see this woman as a potential asset in their community or their profession or whatever it may be. They see him as a threat. And so they start marshaling their traits towards minimizing the threat. And that's where the marginalization and the disrespect come from. It's not from, at least in my experience, it's not from just those who accidentally say the wrong word. That's not what this is about. It's not a game.
Yeah, I think there's this idea. Shiley and I were recently at a conference about women. Those four women specifically in insurance leadership roles. But I think that the takeaways from the conference transcend all industries, quite frankly. And one of the things that was talked about, which I thought was actually so interesting, was this idea of gender tokenism, which, as I now understand it, and I didn't even know what it was going into this, but now walking away, there's this idea that perhaps, yes, there's men, and just like you said, this idea that they're insecure and disrespectful, but that insecurity isn't just limited to men. There's women who, when they finally do get to positions of power, how are we handling that responsibility to pay it forward and in turn bring up other women? And what's been found, according to statistics, and I thought was really interesting, is women. There's this idea of gender tokenism that women are stagnant in terms of raising up other women. So are the question that I can't help but wonder is, are men our problem or are other women our
problem? Ooh, excellent question. Actually, I find women do not help other women, mostly. Not out of jealousy or whatever, certainly men may think. It's because they are not secure enough in their own positions to feel they can reach out and help. So they really want to begin to assign themselves to the boys' clubs, and they want to, because that's where the power is. That's where the weight, that's where the inertia of the power is. And so they want to be in the club. And if the club has decided that you're a threat, or that small pack of folk have decided, or that powerful, influential individual has decided that you're a threat, somebody that needs to be marginalized, they're not going to throw a life preserver out there to help you. They're not going to stand up to make your path any easier, because it may make their path harder. So it's a survivalist move on their point. And I'm very often disappointed. Hey, not in a way that I hope stays with me for very long, because people try to make the best choices they can from day to get by. But And there's been women in elected positions on the bench that people thought, oh, she's going to be the first woman, this and that and the other, that the very first decision she makes is to, you know, throw out a case that would help women or vote against the women's bill. And why does she do that? Maybe it was on merit, or maybe it was because she wanted to be touted as that woman who was so strong. She thumbed her nose at her own kind and aligned with the power. Right? That's what she really did.
I think you hit the nail on the head, because I've given a lot of thought about this. And I do think that there's this idea of self-preservation. It's once you're in that inner sanctum, you're like, they've accepted me. I'm not going to rock that boat. I'm going to try and stay here, and I'm going to do what I need to do to stay in that inner circle. Screw everyone else.
Then what you've really done is you've become a slave to their cause at that point, because you've committed yourself to be aligned with them and not to stand up. And then what happens is it rings a little hollow when you go in to say, okay, look, I've been with you guys on all these things. When she started stepping out of line to try to move herself up, I was with you guys and making sure she stayed in her place. And now I notice that you didn't give me the bonus I thought I needed, or I didn't get the pay raise that I've been working so hard and it my own personal sacrifice to obtain. And they're like, so what? Sorry, you didn't make it. We didn't think you were worth it at the time. What's that person going to do? Who she got? at that point. So she becomes basically aligned with their interests that may not necessarily be hers. It's tough, but if you ever get a little power, I surely hope, speaking to the women out there, the whole generic corporate you, that you utilize it to spread that power and that effect among those and to run, be the wing person for that woman who's maybe stepping out of the box a little bit and support her and see what happens. One, you might change the system to be more friendly towards yourself in the end.
I agree.
Well, one of the things that I really found significant, Teresa, is you gave a commencement speech at Sweetbriar College, at your alma mater. And I think it was in, was it 2017 you gave the speech?
15.
2015. Okay, sorry. Mm-hmm. And you gave an anecdote. And just for our listeners out there, I will link in our show notes the text of Teresa's commencement speech for everybody to listen to the full thing. But you related an anecdote in your speech at commencement of your alma mater, which was an all-women's college, about when you were a young attorney working at your first firm involved in some very serious litigation. And you were, of course, the only woman there, and you were getting ready to make some very significant arguments. And if you're okay with it, what I'd like to do is I'd like to read a little excerpt of your commencement speech to ask you to comment on that.
Sure.
You said, "Many years ago, I was involved in some serious litigation of great proportions. No one in the case was younger than my father. It seemed everyone had gone to an Ivy League college or law school, and I was the 30-something-year-old Sweetbriar-educated lawyer from Columbus, Georgia, who dared to shed a light on things many felt best left in the dark. By all accounts, this case was not going to go well for me. I knew that. Moments before a critical hearing began, I went to the only place I could be alone, the women's restroom, which I think we should all think about, and I stared into the mirror. There, a test of leadership was born, one I use to this day and I commend to you. I asked, am I being reasonable? Have I worked as hard as anyone possibly could on this matter and educated myself to all pertinent information? Have I listened to, thoughtfully considered, and respected contrary views? And lastly, are my motives pure? Do I just want the best right thing to be done, whatever that may be?" And so when I read that, I stopped for a second and I had a moment of my own where I thought, wow, there's nothing about they're treating me unfairly here because I'm a woman. There's nothing about they're treating me unfairly here because I'm younger than all of these men. They're not treating me if I'm some nobody from Columbus, Georgia. Even though you give all of that in your outline, you truly give these four questions that are this test of what you describe later as a foundation of justifiable righteousness. And you say that is the basis on which you know that you can say bold and necessarily controversial things. Mm-hmm. So first of all, wow. Actually, if you were able to come up with those kinds of cogent questions when you were a 30-something, because I'm there and I barely know what I'm going to do for dinner. But tell us a little more about that moment, if you wouldn't mind, and how that mantra and those questions have been applied to other milestones in your life. And also, why you felt like that was so important to share with a group of women who were graduating from college, who were 22 at that moment in 2015.
I'll tell you, hearing that, I don't listen to that speech every day, as you might imagine. It really makes me very emotional. One, for the time I was giving that speech and the desperation of the college and all the people that cared about it and what a breaking point we were at, but also for that young woman who was completely alone and was well beyond her capacity. Looking into that mirror, I remember being there. I had a paralegal and a young associate, maybe a first or second year associate from the local law firm, local counsel, who we had associated so we could, it was in federal court in Minnesota, and it was a nationwide class action against the fourth largest bank in the world. And they had Skadden Arps came in with maybe 10 lawyers. they had flown in. I think King and Spalding was involved. They had a row or two of lawyers, and Briggs and Morgan, and Vedder Price. So they had four law firms. Vedder Price, one of the largest firms in the world at the time, and they had a very large Chicago office. So they had come in from New York and Chicago and all over the country. And it was me and this paralegal and this second year associate whose name I at the time wasn't sure I remembered. And so it was a David and Goliath, to say the least. And I was way over my head. The last time we'd been together, the Briggs and Morgan counsel had been talking to the judge about their golf game the weekend before. These people knew each other. And so I remember I thought I was going to vomit. Why not? It was so far over my head. And
I have a really hard time picturing you as anything other than composed. So it's reassuring to me to hear.
I will tell you that I once heard somebody say something. I thought, oh my God, that's so true. The one thing I've always had going for me is that I was very brave. And the reason why I think people need to find their brave spot. I heard somebody say once that people are brave if they can very quickly do their cost benefit analysis of how much they're willing to lose. And they talked about that people who've had a breaking point in their life, whatever it may be, it didn't have to be one that if we put it out in the world and people started voting on it, 75% of the people would think that should be a breaking point, but that you felt like was a breaking point. You felt like you were all alone or whatever it might be. And it usually happens young in life. And once you've had it, if you've really been brought to your knees as a human being, really in your mind been brought to your knees, you know what low is. You know what your base is, and you know what you're willing to lose. And if you internalize that and you feel you have it, then as you go forward in life, quickly you make a decision. Okay, I'm willing to lose this much. And your brave point. Okay, I can be brave because I'm willing to lose to here. So I'm going to be brave at this point going forward. And that's where I was, right? I didn't really have anywhere to go. And there was a freedom in that. And so I went in and I just thought, I remember like the Eminem song from the movie, Eight Mile, you got one shot to go.
Yeah.
You got one shot.
And but this hopefully, is it. Hopefully no mom spaghetti on your sweater. No,
I who knows, but no, I did not have mom spaghetti, but God knows what else. Was going on, but it did. It released me to say things, and I remember, as I say later on in the speech, because it was true, I thought I have 2 seconds to get this out there, and I just started saying judge, and boom, I just went straight to the meat and potatoes. I didn't lead up to it. All started with X, and then we went to Y. I just said we're here because, and I laid it low. And just started talking. And the local counsel who knew the judge jumped up and said, Your Honor, this isn't the way we do things. And the judge just turned and looked at that guy. Well, that's the way we're doing it right now. And and went and we won that hearing. It was amazing. It turned the case around. And I could write a book about that particular case. But yeah, that test was born of that. And it's that moment when you somehow say to yourself and hopefully every woman gets there on her own. If she doesn't, let this be it. You know what you're doing. I can assure you of that. I've lived a lot of life and I have yet to see a woman unprepared.
Yeah.
Ever.
Amen.
And all you need is the confidence, and you should have it because you are prepared. You know it better than anybody else. And so stand up there and show it. And that's where that test was born from, a breaking point. So let my breaking point be everybody else's motivation.
My breaking point is coming soon, too. This is, Teresa, you are so inspirational. And I think if nothing else, the hope, at least from today's episode, and we could talk about this for days, it's cramming everything into a 30-minute podcast is so difficult because it's stories like yours stacked on top of stories with others that really just paves the road to something that's really amazing. And looking and hearing your history and your stuff that you've experienced, it's so inspirational for me. And I'm thrilled that we get to call you a colleague, a friend, a partner, a female in our crew. I think Shiley had a really important one more question for you to really solidify your membership in this, in our Litigators Lounge, though.
Yeah, we've talked about hot toddies, we've talked about lychee martinis, but I think that the masses need to know, what is Teresa Tomlinson's drink of choice?
First of all, I'm a litigator, so yes, I do drink. As I said to a young associate when we were in federal court trying that case we recently got that big verdict on, I said, you are going to have to handle the jury instructions. I was overloaded with other stuff going on. And she looked at me. She's been a lawyer for 14 months. And I said, do you drink? And she said, sometimes. And I said, we are about to start. But in any event, I for as complicated a life I live, I love a good red blend that is drinkable. That is an easy, palatable thing. People are like, you look so complicated. Don't you like a little this, that? Just give me something that's drinkable. And yeah, can I do the fancy drinks on the, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. But my drink of choice is give me a red drinkable wine. And it is amazing how I very much enjoy the easy things. And I think that's because I live otherwise a very complicated life with the things I choose to do.
Well, tonight, I think you deserve a glass of easy red wine. I know I, for one, need a lychee martini for sure. But
Teresa,
you know,
if our listeners were interested in talking to you about legal matters, can you give just a really brief sketch of what your current practice entails and what kinds of matters you're typically handling these days?
Yeah, I'm doing the complex litigation, and what that is, a fancy way to say that it's got a lot going on. I'm an expert in organizing a case towards resolution, not so much in the subject matter. So I've done banking, aviation, med mal, whatever it may be. And I may not know that area of the law so well, but I learn and become a master of it. I'm trying to organize the case in a way that makes it go away much sooner for the defendant or the plaintiff. Gets it resolved. And I love it because it's a big, giant puzzle. So that's what I do. I'm working a lot in some fiduciary litigation cases that have gotten very mucked up. And I do some defense cases where you're talking way excess of coverage and somebody may or may not be in peril, or otherwise they're very complicated, pending in multiple jurisdictions, that type of thing. I like the Rubik's Cubes. Give me the Rubik's
you're
Cube.
You're a fixer.
Case.
You're like the Ray Donovan of only it's way more complicated. You're the go-to. That's fantastic. Mm-hmm. I love it. We're going to raise a toast to you and all the other queens who've ruled empires and ruled the office and ruled the courtroom.
I think this is our official cheers moment.
Cheers, Clink. Thank you, Teresa. We appreciate you coming on. Thank you, Shiley. And thank you to all the women who continue to make history every day and doing it with style.
Absolutely. Thank you, guys. And Teresa, I'm sure we will have you on again to the Litigators Lounge to talk about other things as well. For all of our listeners out there, we have some exciting programming coming up. We're going to be doing an immigration series. So for those of you who are in workplace law that deals with immigration, that will be something that you will want to tune into. If you have any questions for Teresa, Jackie, or me, comments or discussions that you'd like us to engage in here in the Litigators Lounge, please feel free to send us an email at litigatorslounge@hallboothsmith.com. So far, the only ones we've gotten have been from our relatives, so please help us out. But for now, this is us signing off, and we hope that everybody has a wonderful end of March and end of Women's History Month. Cheers.
Cheers.
Thank you
for joining us on Litigators Lounge. This show is brought to you by Hall Booth Smith, helping clients navigate the complexities of workplace legal issues. For more information, go to hallboothsmith.com.
Litigators Lounge is a production brought to you by Hall Booth Smith. This podcast is published for the purposes of providing general information and education on topics which include those related to the law and legal issues. But the contents of this podcast do not constitute legal advice. Listening to this podcast or utilizing the information contained in it in any way does not constitute, nor does it create, an attorney-client relationship between you and Hall Booth Smith or its lawyers. The contents of this podcast should not be used as a substitute for competent legal advice from a professional attorney licensed in your jurisdiction.